Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and we have a very fun one for you today. Heather Radke is an SAS journalist and contributing editor and reporter at Radiolab, the Peabody award-winning program from WNYC. She's written for publications including The Believer, Longreads, and The Paris Review, and she teaches at Columbia University's Creative Writing MFA program. Her debut, which is kind of like a critical history, let's say, it is called Butts, A Backstory. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Heather, why butts? And I asked that as a two-part question. Mm-hmm. What made you want to write about butts, and what made you decide to call the book butts when there are so many different adjectives and euphemisms to describe that area?
Such a good question. Well, I'll tackle the second one first, which is that, you know, it was never called anything else. I always thought it should be called butts. I think part of it is that you get such a reaction. You say the word butt to people, and I have been saying it to people for about 5 years now, pretty regularly. And I mean, one of the things I talk about in the intro actually is about just how even the word itself kind of makes it so that we struggle to name this part of our body correctly. And even the word butts is a euphemism. So mm-hmm. there's no correct word. And I was pretty interested in that as almost like a symbolic representation for one of the things I was trying to say in the book, which was, you know, this is a part of our body that we sort of don't take seriously. And we don't always think super complicated thoughts about, but it's actually, there's such a rich and complicated history to it. And I guess I just wondered, what if we did take it seriously? Like, what mm-hmm. might we discover?
And yeah, then in the intro, you remind us that like, it's kind of shocking to see like a picture of your butt because it's just not a view that you normally have.
Totally. I mean, it's like every time I've ever seen a picture of my own butt, or sort of you catch it in the mirror or whatever, it's always a little bit of it's definitely a shock. You kind of it's not a part of your body that you always know what it looks like. It's sort of more for other people, or it's more often observed by other people than it is by yourself.
And yet it's still a source of shame or pride, depending on what's happening in the culture at that very moment.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the you know, our feelings about our butt are so context dependent, you know, geography, mm-hmm. identity in all kinds of ways, you know, what decade we're living in, what decade we grew up in, what stories our aunts and mothers told us about our bodies. So but I think it is kind of uniquely positioned on the body. Well, not uniquely, I suppose, like your back and the back of your neck and maybe your calves or something are all sort of similarly positioned. But it's interesting that, like, because you can't see it yourself, that like it's always sort of being what, not just what it looks like, but what it means is kind of being put onto it rather than something that's a little bit maybe easier to take ownership over, like your face maybe.
Right. And so you start out getting into the more biological, evolutionary kind of ideas about what purpose does a butt serve? And there are a few theories, if you want to take us through a couple.
Well, there's kind of like two parts of the butt. And here we should probably say, like, oh, yeah. This book focuses on women's butts specifically. And as I'm often put in the position of saying, it's the cheeks, not the hole. So like, it's kind of important because actually there's like entire other books that could be written about all of those things. And actually, as I say in the intro too, like there's many more books that could be written about women's butts too. Mm-hmm. Which is why I insisted on calling it a backstory instead of the backstory, which was a conversation we had at some length. Okay, so the biology of the butt, it's basically like there's a muscle and then there's fat on top of the muscle. The muscle is relatively straightforward because it's actually just a lot easier to know what muscles are for evolutionarily and biologically. So the butt muscle, the gluteus maximus, and there's a couple of other ones in there, they help us to run and jump. And that actually helped us to become like very good hunters in the early days of the Homo sapien hominid moment. And that helped us to basically, like, you can run down an antelope and you can run forever and ever, and the antelope can only sprint, and eventually it wears itself out and dies, and you can beat it over the head. It's so gruesome. And then all of a sudden you can like eat all of these, this like massive amount of calories that's stored up in an animal, like an antelope. And that helped us to be able to have big brains and have babies with long gestations and all kinds of things that were crucial for our humanity. But the fat on women's butts specifically is really complicated and really hard to know. I mean, there's like a relatively straightforward answer, which is like female humans have more fat on their bodies than almost any other animal on Earth. And that is because it's very energetically expensive, as scientists say, to bear a child and breastfeed. As I'm well aware, I'm like breastfeeding my baby like 45 yeah. times a day. But then there's a question of like, so then why does that fat have to be stored where it is? As one scientist said to me, like, you know, it could just be like the fat could have just been in our knees or our elbows or whatever. And maybe that it's just stored in our butts and bellies because that makes it's like you wouldn't topple over in the way that you might if it was like stored in your shoulders. So like that's a pretty straightforward and probably, you know, simple, makes sense kind of answer. But there's a lot of theories that emerged in the last, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, as a part of evolutionary psychology that offer kind of other explanations that are pretty dubious and also can cause kind of a lot of harm if they're not handled carefully, you know. So some people think that women with big butts are more fertile than women without big butts. The science behind that is very thin and not very good, I don't think. And I think it's those kinds of studies are often like cited in like Maxim magazine and kind of
sure.
Like, but we should be really careful with saying that kind of stuff because what it does is it suggests that there's a kind of butt or a kind of body that's more correct or more fit or more evolved even in some sense than another one. And that's actually just, there's no evidence to support that being the case. As once a philosopher of science said to me, any butt that's not killing you is good enough.
Doing its job.
Yeah.
And yeah, there you talk a lot in the book about women's bodies are just not uniform. They contain so much fat, but you can't predict where. Everybody yeah. who stood in a dressing room knows this for a fact.
Yeah, it's definitely like the thing that maybe most people kind of talk to me about the book, and that I one of the ways I did early research for the book was I did oral histories with women and non-binary people about their bodies, because one of the things I was interested in was like basically creating like a deep history of a very personal and relatively mundane feeling, which is like standing in a dressing room and having clothes that don't fit. But I also knew that I only had one experience of being in a body. And so I wanted to make sure I had conversations with other people to understand what their experience was. But most people I talked to, if not all of them, had something to say about that moment in the dressing room, you know, because clothes, it can feel bad when clothes don't fit your body. But as I learned in reporting the book, like, they're kind of not supposed to fit your body. I mean, it really doesn't feel like that's true, but they can't. It's basically impossible. The only way you could ever have clothes that fit you really well is if you made them yourself and tailored them to your specific body. So,
which is, of course, how clothes have been made for many, many centuries until.
Yeah, until. I mean, actually, the way a lot of clothes were made until really recently, especially for non-rich people, was like, here's a tunic and here's a belt, you know, like yes. You get a little bit. That's like a forgiving garment. You know what I mean? I think it's sort of one of the better ways of having clothes work. But yeah, the history of size is very fraught and complicated and sort of weirdly, I don't think it's, I mean, hidden is sort of a complicated word, but to some extent, I think it's very unknown considering how much low-level harm it causes all of us on a daily basis. So
it felt comforting to realize that you do put theory behind a lot of this, a lot of these feelings that I couldn't quite name. Like, I did abs of steel every day in the 90s, not buns because I was a little more concerned. I did not have an itty bitty waist, as Sir Mix-a-Lot would say. Yeah. And I hadn't considered how that plays into the idea of the hardworking American who can lift themselves up by the, I was almost going to say butt straps.
Well, that's kind of good. That sort of seems right. The rise of fitness culture like really maps on in an interesting way to the rise of neoliberalism. And it makes so much sense, right? Like taking control of your own body. And so it's very similar to this idea that it's like, it's your responsibility to make the money and make sure your life is what you want it to be. Just like it's your responsibility to have a body that looks good and is healthy and is perfect. And of course, both of those things are myths. I mean, you can't, there's obviously like more than I could even begin to say with the problems of neoliberalism here, but with the stuff about the body, it's like, you know, there's ways you can change your body, but there's a lot of ways you can't. And one of my favorite parts of reporting this book was when I talked to the women who are part of the fat fitness movement the women I talked to were doing fat fitness in the Bay Area in the 80s. And they were really excited about the parts of the aerobics movement that seemed really fun and exciting, which was like being able to move their bodies and feel strong and healthy. But they were not interested in, you know, conforming to these ideals that they just basically were never going to live up to. So, you know, they created a whole kind of counterculture of aerobics that, where they could modify exercises, they could dance around the room, they could sort of live joyfully in the bodies that they had. And I found their story to be like quite profound and really fun.
We're still trying to define that joy.
Yeah, totally.
So many of us. And yeah, there's also the idea that like, if I work hard, I should be able to earn a living, or if I work hard, I should be able to achieve my goals. And your body is just another thing that is not exactly as in your control as you might want, that neoliberalism wants you to think.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing, I'm so glad you picked up on this theme. It's like, over and over again, it's like you just see the way a body is what it's going to be. And humans have this like strange desire to order bodies and control bodies and, you know, try to almost turn them into industrial products, like interchangeable parts or something. But bodies always kind of end up resisting that. It's really not that easy to change your body, actually. Like, I mean, you can do buns of steel all day long, but your butt is not going to actually change that much without surgery, frankly. And I mean, lots of people do have BBLs and, you know, that's like a whole other conversation, I guess, but I actually often kind of find it a little bit like delightful that bodies are so resistant to our efforts to change them and order them and turn them into something that, you know, is sort of uniform instead of very, very specific.
And you have this really fascinating moment in the book when you explain who Norma is and why the hunt for Norma was so exciting for capitalists.
And eugenicists. So
and
Norma,
eugenicists.
So in the late 30s and early 40s, there was this kind of interest in the normal. And these two guys, a artist and a gynecologist, like classic combo, right? Like, they got together and they decided to make these two statues, Norma and Norm Man. And they wanted to show Americans what the ideal body was, but for them, the ideal body was the most normal body. But that's like one of the ways, an interesting place where we see, kind of see an interesting tension where like the normal is also the perfect. And so they found these two sets of data. One of those data sets is really interesting. It helped to sort of go and turn into like the how we make clothes fit, which is like another story. But so they have these two sets of data, one for Norma, one for Norman, and they create these kind of like bizarre statues that are like the perfectly average, perfectly normal, white, able-bodied, American-born woman and man. And they display them in the Museum of Natural History in New York. And then eventually those statues go to Cleveland. And then they actually have a contest in Cleveland to kind of reverse engineer Norma to try to find the most normal girl in Cleveland who fits this, the measurements of this statue that were created out of like the average of all these American women. And of course they like can't find one. They find what's this one woman, Martha Skidmore, who's the closest, but I mean, a thing I just find that's so interesting is just like, again, they're putting forward this idea of the normal, but like it's still an unattainable ideal because you actually can't find somebody with this like perfectly average set of measurements. And of course, there's also like so much wrong with their data set in addition to that, which is like they got rid of all the women of color. And at that time, that probably would have also included Jewish women and Italian women and Eastern European women, although that's not entirely clear in this data set, because what they weren't, of course, trying to find the most average American woman in any real sense. They were trying to find like the most perfect eugenicist woman, basically. So they had to monkey with the data to get that.
And it's, I didn't realize until you reminded me that Norma and Norman were put in a museum, that this is another theme of your book. The abasement of average people, or the, certainly the debasement of the woman who in the early 19th century came to really symbolize all of the racial coding about our butts.
So Sarah Bartman, she was born in what is now South Africa at the beginning of the 19th century. And she was brought up to London around 1810 to be displayed in a freak show in London because she had a big butt, and big butts by that time had become linked with African women as part of a, you know, obviously pseudoscientific project of creating race, essentially, and creating racial hierarchies. So people weren't just using skin color to create racial hierarchies, but were also starting to use body type. And so these two men brought Sarah Bartman up and they displayed her in this freak show. And then eventually she ended up in Paris, where she died, and her body was dissected by a man named Georges Cuvier, who was one of the most famous scientists of the 19th century. He invented paleontology, but he was very invested in this project of creating racial hierarchies. And when he performed an autopsy on her body, he used that autopsy report as evidence, and so did many, many other people for the next at least 100 years, for evidence of white people being of a higher racial order than African people. And then he also displayed her body parts in his museum. And actually, they stayed displayed in Paris until the 1980s. So it's really something that still, you know, lives very much in all of our lifetimes. And the stereotypes that he was enshrining in that autopsy report have retained quite a lot of potency. And we see them, you sort of see them all the time, even today, over and over again, this idea of the big butted hypersexual Black woman, and even the big butted white woman later on in the 19th century, other scientists started to say that, I mean, they're not like, to even call them scientists is a little bit weird, but that's what they thought they were. They started to also do these studies with sex workers, white sex workers, and where they would say, oh, like this hypersexual women have big butts, and that's just, there is a kind of physiological link.
And if there is a physiological link, then your average man has reason. Yeah, can't help himself, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of course, what ultimately they were doing with creating this hypersexual Black woman was, it's a justification in some sense of for rape and as a way to continue slavery in the American South. So it's a very dark and upsetting and really tragic story that is, you know, still lives with us in pretty profound ways.
It does. And one of the things that you get into after that is the idea that perhaps even in that era, white women were appropriating things that were not culturally theirs, this time by perhaps inventing or wearing a bustle in their Victorian outfits.
Yeah, so it was actually one of the first things I got interested in when I was trying to figure out if this was a book project or an essay project or what, was I started to think about the bustle, which is this sort of bizarre 19th century garment, undergarment, where it's like a cage or a pad, or people sometimes just use newspaper that you just tie around your waist, and it makes your butt look, frankly, like enormous. It's like it creates quite a striking silhouette. And I just was sort of like, why did people do that? What a weird thing to do. And I pretty quickly found a theory that's, you know, you see it kind of pop up throughout like the 20th century about the bustle, which is that it mimics the silhouette that was very commonly seen of Sarah Bartman in the early 19th century. And so, you know, you can never really know why a fashion becomes a fashion. It's one of the actually, frankly, like very interesting things about clothes is it's because it's not textual, it has like a slightly different way of mode of understanding and mode of making meaning. But I think it's pretty clear to me that at least one of the things that was going on with the bustle was that it was a visual echo of Sarah Bartman's body, and a way for white women to kind of play in Blackness in a way that we're maybe pretty these days. It's maybe more familiar in a character like Miley Cyrus or something, but and you know, less extreme examples also. But there was this way with a bustle that they could literally strap on this fake butt and then at the end of the day take it off. And it's you know, it's something the cultural critic Greg Tate might call, he didn't say this about the bustle, but I sort of say it's a similar idea, is, you know, it's a way that white people can take on everything but the burden. They can they can put on Blackness and then take it off as it sort of suits them, and play around inside of these stereotypes that they themselves have created.
And then of course you get further into fashion trends, and it becomes very clear that, or it's always been clear, let's say, that anything that we're told is empowering or liberating often is not. And your first example of that was the idea that women were getting rid of their corsets and they're no longer physically confined in the days of flappers in the 20s. But still that physical confinement is there. It just kind of comes from within.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is an idea that the kind of brilliant fashion historian Valerie Steele first put forward, which is like the corset kind of, instead of being on the outside of the body, it comes inside the body. And instead of having a garment that confines you and creates a silhouette, you actually have to confine yourself and create a silhouette. So in the 20s, you see the invention of like the bathroom scale and the fad diet, and, you know, women are chewing nicotine gum to lose weight, and the first plastic surgeries are happening. So instead of having bustles and corsets and petticoats that are creating a silhouette, it's like the job of the woman to create a silhouette. And I mean, I don't want to wear a corset every day for sure, but like you have to start to wonder which is actually worse. And I think that there's this narrative about the Victorians, you know, that they were so confined and that the corset was this torture device. And I mean, I suppose it doesn't make it any less of a torture device to have found a new torture device, but I think it's just an interesting thing to always ask, like, to question the that particular narrative of liberation, because that silhouette, the sort of super, you know, that what some people call the rectangle woman, it's really stayed with us for at least 100 years. And it's, you know, now there's all these articles coming out that's like skinny's back,
heroin chic is back.
Yeah, which is, you know, in some sense you could make an argument it never really left.
Yes,
but it's a very pervasive form, and it's a silhouette of control. You know, it's not a silhouette of liberation in the way that even heroin chic, you know, there's a way that that's like a grunge kind of cool subcultural thing, but what it asks of women is to create a body that, you know, most women could only have if they were starving themselves or on drugs, I guess, if this is the sort of what they're talking about when they say heroin chic.
And the talking about corsets, of course, brings me back to, we had to end up with Kim Kardashian at the end anyway. And to me, that feels like the epitome of the backwardness of our times, that she still waist trains, mm-hmm. celebrates her butt, but there's a very specific way that she can, there's a very specific way that her body needs to look. And if she deviates from that, people won't love her as much on Instagram. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about Kim Kardashian, but I think it's like none of, you know, it's not a size acceptance movement that she's starting. No. It never was, right? Like, it's not, she's not saying all bodies are beautiful. She's saying, buy my waist trainer, you know what I mean? So, you know, I think to the extent that big butts have come into mainstream fashion, there's so much to say about how and why that mm-hmm. happened, but it's not like every butt is good, and it's not like every big butt is good. I mean, Kim Kardashian's butt is sculpted and managed and created, and what she's demanding is that, you know, to the extent that she's the one driving that trend, it's that she, you know, she's saying you should look like me, which is going to require a lot of work. And you know, that's what, you know, when I was looking at all these kind of like magazine articles in the aughts and 2010s, and newspaper articles, and in people to follow on Instagram, you know, they're all trying to sell you something. And the only way they can sell you something is by telling you that what you have now isn't right, and that if you buy or do this thing, you will become right. So it's still a question of control and hierarchies and telling women that their bodies are in some sense incorrect. Which is depressing. I know it sounds all sort of depressing. I promise it's also fun.
it's very fun. Well, so let's talk about fun. Because you spend a long time talking about Big Freedia. Tell me about twerking in this context.
Well, I was pretty interested in the question of like what had happened in the 2010s specifically, and why so many white women had gotten interested in big butts and having them and shaking them, I guess. And twerk was a way for me to explore that question. But one of the things that I really liked learning about was about the history of this dance that's very old and very liberating. And, you know, it has a Big Frida is this, she's a drag queen from New Orleans who is, you know, helped to found the bounce, which is the dance, the music form that twerk is really like the dance for in a lot of ways. And, you know, for her, it's a dance of liberation, and it's a dance of liberation that comes out of these very old forms of dance that came over with enslaved people and came up from the Caribbean and South America and kind of mingled and merged in New Orleans and other parts of the South, and eventually combined with dance hall and other forms of 20th century dance, and became this dance form that's like really about having a lot of fun. And then of course, as it always is, it's, you know, then it becomes appropriated by white people, specifically by Miley Cyrus in 2013. But I think knowing the history of something like twerk, and honestly the history of butts, I think there's a way you can sort of not take twerk very seriously if you don't think very hard about it. You know, it's like this booty dance, shake your booty, whatever. And that's, and to some extent that does the dance a disservice. It's actually an important dance that can tell us a lot about American culture and American history. And there's a lot of joy and fun in learning that and finding out about these kind of like nuances of the things that we don't always take as seriously as we might. So when I talked to scholars like Kira Gaunt about that, and when I like really started to learn about these early days of twerk, just for me, I think it helps me to see the world in a more complex and exciting way.
I love that. But a backstory out now. Heather, before we go, would you please recommend some books for us?
Sure, yeah. Okay, so the first book I want to recommend is The History of White People by Nell Painter. This book, like in my early research for Butts, was totally profound, kind of life-changing book. Painter is a really well-known African-American historian who had written a book that was a kind of encyclopedic volume about the history of Black America. And then she wrote this kind of counter history, the history of white people. And I think one of the things that's so important about this book is that it helps us to see the way that whiteness is constructed just as much as any other racial category. And it's full of just fascinating and obviously very upsetting historical details. One of my favorite books that came out this year is Easy Beauty by Chloe Cooper Jones. Maybe you've had her on.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful book that helps us sort of think in new ways about what beauty is and what bodies are. And it's just so beautifully written and a real pleasure to read. And then one of my favorite books and kind of a model for Butts is a book called Let's Talk About Love by Carl Wilson. Do you know this book?
Yes.
It's called Let's Talk About Love, A Journey to the End of Taste. And it's about Celine Dion. And Wilson is a Canadian music critic. This book is probably about 20 years old. And he basically asks, why do I hate Celine Dion so much? And then he takes it so seriously. And I think like one of the things I was super interested in doing in this book is thinking about things we don't always take seriously, and then wondering what might happen when we do. And the Celine Dion book it's such a pleasure to read. It's so fun, but it's also like a earnest and thoughtful investigation of taste, which is like such an important thing that forms not only how we think about culture, but also how we think about bodies, like what we think is beautiful, what we think is sexy, what we think is good. Those are in some sense questions of taste, and his willingness to kind of push against his own assumptions is something that I really admire. And the way he constructed that book, I think, is just kind of brilliant.
Love that. Thank you so much, Heather.
Oh, thank you. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.